Mattia cried out, and ran staggering across the passage into the forester's room. The forester waked up at once, but hearing that the other room was full of fumes, to Mattia's surprise and annoyance, accepted the fact with strange unconcern, though he did go to see to it. But he's dead, and... What am I to do then? Cried Mattia frantically. They threw open the doors, opened a window and the chimney. Mattia brought a pail of water from the passage. First he wetted his own head, then, finding a rag of some sort, dipped it into the water, and put it on Lyagavi's head. The forester still treated the matter contemptuously, and when he opened the window said grumpily, "It'll be all right, now." He went back to sleep, leaving Mattia a lighted lantern. Mattia fussed about the drunken peasant for half an hour, wetting his head, and gravely resolved not to sleep all night. But he was so worn out that when he sat down for a moment to take breath, he closed his eyes, unconsciously stretched himself full length on the bench and slept like the dead. It was dreadfully late when he waked. It was somewhere about 9 o'clock. The sun was shining brightly in the two little windows of the hut. The curly, headed peasant was sitting on the bench and had his coat on. He had another samovar and another bottle in front of him. Yesterday's bottle had already been finished, and the new one was more than half empty. Mattia jumped up and saw at once that the cursed peasant was drunk again, hopelessly and incurably. He stared at him for a moment with wide-opened eyes. The peasant was silently and slyly watching him, with insulting composure, and even a sort of contemptuous condescension, so Mattia fancied. He rushed up to him. "Excuse me, you see. You've most likely heard from the forester here in the hut. I'm Lieutenant Dmitri Karamazov, the son of the old Karamazov whose copse you are buying." "That's a lie," said the peasant, calmly and confidently. "A lie. You know Fyodor Pavlovich?"
"I don't know any of your Fyodor Pavloviches," said the peasant, speaking thickly.
"You're bargaining with him for the copse, for the copse. Do wake up, and collect yourself. Father Pavel of Ilinsku brought me here. You wrote to Samsonov, and he has sent me to you," Mattia gasped breathlessly.
"You're lying,"
Lyagavi blurted out again. Mattia's legs went cold. "For mercy's sake? It isn't a joke. You're drunk, perhaps. Yet you can speak and understand. Or else.
I understand nothing. You're a painter.
For mercy's sake?
I'm Karamazov. Dmitri Karamazov.
I have an offer to make you, an advantageous offer. Very advantageous offer, concerning the copse." The peasant stroked his beard importantly. "No, you've contracted for the job and turned out to I assure you you're mistaken," cried Mattia, wringing his hands in despair. The peasant still stroked his beard, and suddenly screwed up his eyes cunningly. "No, you show me this. You tell me the law that allows roguery. Do you hear? You're a scoundrel. Do you understand that?" Mattia stepped back gloomily, and suddenly something seemed to hit him on the head, as he said afterwards. In an instant a light seemed to dawn in his mind. A light was kindled and I grasped it all. He stood, stupefied, wondering how he, after all a man of intelligence, could have yielded to such folly, have been led into such an adventure, and have kept it up for almost 24 hours, fussing round this Lyagavi, wetting his head. "Why, the man's drunk, dead drunk, and he'll go on drinking now for a week. What's the use of waiting here? And what if Samsonov sent me here on purpose? What if she? Oh God, what have I done?" The peasant sat watching him and grinning. Another time Mattia might have killed the fool in a fury, but now he felt as weak as a child. He went quietly to the bench, took up his overcoat, put it on without a word, and went out of the hut. He did not find the forester in the next room. There was no one there. He took 50 kopecks in small change out of his pocket and put them on the table for his night's lodging, the candle, and the trouble he had given. Coming out of the hut he saw nothing but forest all round. He walked at hazard, not knowing which way to turn out of the hut, to the right or to the left.
hurrying the evening before with the priest, he had not noticed the road. He had no revengeful feeling for anybody, even for Samsonov, in his heart. He strode along a narrow forest path, aimless, dazed, without heeding where he was going. A child could have knocked him down, so weak was he in body and soul. He got out of the forest somehow, however, and a vista of fields, bare after the harvest, stretched as far as the eye could see. What despair! What death all round! He repeated, striding on and on. He was saved by meeting an old merchant who was being driven across country in a hired trap. When he overtook him, Mitya asked the way, and it turned out that the old merchant, too, was going to Volovia. After some discussion, Mitya got into the trap. 3 hours later they arrived. At Volovia, Mitya at once ordered posting, horses to drive to the town, and suddenly realized that he was appallingly the horses were being harnessed. An omelette was prepared for him. He ate it all in an instant, ate a huge hunk of bread, ate a sausage, and swallowed 3 glasses of vodka. After eating, his spirits and his heart grew lighter. He flew towards the town, urged on the driver, and suddenly made a new and unalterable plan to procure that accursed money before evening. And to think, only to think, that a man's life should be ruined for the sake of that paltry 3,000. He cried, contemptuously. I'll settle it today. And if it had not been for the thought of Grushenka and of what might have happened to her, which never left him, he would perhaps have become quite cheerful again. But the thought of her was stabbing him to the heart every moment, like a sharp knife. At last they arrived, and Mitya at once ran to Grushenka. Chapter 3, Gold Mines. This was the visit of Mitya of which Grushenka had spoken to Rakitin with such horror. She was just then expecting the message, and was much relieved that Mitya had not been to see her that day or the day before. She hoped that, please God, he won't come till I'm gone away, and he suddenly burst in on her. The rest we know already. To get him off her hands, she suggested at once that he should walk with her to Samsonov's, where she said she absolutely must go to settle his accounts, and when Mitya accompanied her at once, she said good-bye to him at the gate, making him promise to come at 12 o'clock to take her home again. Mitya, too, was delighted at this arrangement. If she was sitting at Samsonov's, she could not be going to Fyodor Pavlovich's, if only she's not lying, he added at once. But he thought she was not. He was that sort of jealous man who, in the absence of the beloved woman, at once invents all sorts of awful fancies of what may be happening to her, and how she may be betraying him, but, when shaken, heartbroken, convinced of her faithlessness, he runs back to her, at the first glance at her face, her gay, laughing, affectionate face. He revives at once, lays aside all suspicion, and with joyful shame abuses himself for his jealousy. After leaving Grushenka at the gate, he rushed home. Oh, he had so much still to do that day. But a load had been lifted from his heart, anyway. Now I must only make haste and find out from Smerdyakov whether anything happened the last night, whether, by any chance, she went to Fyodor Pavlovich, or floated through his mind. Before he had time to reach his lodging, jealousy had surged up again in his restless heart. Jealousy. Othello was not jealous, he was trustful, observed Pushkin. And that remark alone is enough to show the deep insight of our great poet. Othello's soul was shattered and his whole outlook clouded simply because his ideal was destroyed. But Othello did not begin hiding, spying, peeping. He was trustful, on the contrary. He had to be led up, pushed on, excited with great difficulty before he could entertain the idea of deceit. The truly jealous man is not like that. It is impossible to picture to oneself the shame and moral degradation to which the jealous man can descend without a qualm of conscience. And yet it's not as though the jealous were all vulgar and base souls. On the contrary, a man of lofty feelings, whose love is pure and full of self-sacrifice, may yet hide under tables, bribe the vilest people, and be familiar with the lowest ignominy of spying and eavesdropping. Othello was incapable of making up his mind to faithlessness, not incapable of forgiving it, but of making up his mind to it, though his soul was as innocent and free from malice as a babe's. It is not so with a really jealous man. It is hard to imagine what some jealous men can make up their mind to and overlook, and what they can forgive. The jealous are the readiest of all to forgive, and all women know it. The jealous man can forgive extraordinarily quickly, though, of course, after a violent scene, and he is able to forgive infidelity almost conclusively proved, the very kisses and embraces he has seen, if only he can somehow be convinced that it has all been for the last time, and that his rival will vanish from that day forward, will depart to the ends of the earth, or that he himself will carry her away somewhere, where the dreaded rival will not get near her. Of course the reconciliation is only for an hour. For, even if the rival did disappear next day, he would invent another one and would be jealous of him. And one might wonder what there was in a love that had to be so watched over, what a love could be worth that needed such strenuous guarding. But that the jealous will never understand. And yet among them are men of noble hearts. It is remarkable, too, that those very men of noble hearts, standing hidden in some cupboard, listening and spying, never feel the stings of conscience at that moment, anyway, though they understand clearly enough with their noble hearts the shameful depths to which they have voluntarily sunk. At the sight of Grushenka, Mitya's jealousy vanished, and, for an instant he became trustful and generous, and positively despised himself for his evil feelings. But it only proved that, in his love for the woman, there was an element of something far higher than he himself imagined, that it was not only a sensual passion, not only the curve of her body, of which he had talked to Alishaw. But, as soon as Grushenka had gone, Mitya began to suspect her of all the low cunning of faithlessness, and he felt no sting of conscience at it. And so jealousy surged up in him again. He had, in any case, to make haste. The first thing to be done was to get hold of at least a small, temporary loan of money. The 9 rubles had almost all gone on his expedition. And, as we all know, one can't take a step without money. But he had thought over in the cart where he could get a loan. He had a brace of fine dueling pistols in a case, which he had not pawned till then because he prized them above all his possessions. In the Metropolis tavern he had some time since made acquaintance with a young official and had learned that this very opulent bachelor was passionately fond of weapons. He used to buy pistols, revolvers, daggers, hang them on his wall and show them to acquaintances. He prided himself on them, and was quite a specialist on the mechanism of the revolver. Mitya, without stopping to think, went straight to him, and offered to pawn his pistols to him for 10 rubles. The official, delighted, began trying to persuade him to sell them outright. But Mitya would not consent, so the young man gave him 10 rubles, protesting that nothing would induce him to take interest. They parted friends. Mitya was in haste. He rushed towards Fyodor Pavlovich's by the back way, to his arbor, to get hold of Smerdyakov as soon as possible. In this way, the fact was established that 3 or 4 hours before a certain event, of which I shall speak later on, Mitya had not a farthing, and pawned for 10 rubles a possession he valued, though, 3 hours later, he was in possession of thousands. But I am anticipating. From Maria Kondratovna, the woman living near Fyodor Pavlovich's, he learned the very disturbing fact of Smerdyakov's illness. He heard the story of his fall in the cellar. His fit, the doctor's visit, Fyodor Pavlovich's anxiety. He heard with interest, too, that his brother Ivan had set off that morning for Moscow. Then he must have driven through Volovia before me, thought Dmitri, but he was terribly distressed about Smerdyakov. What will happen now? Who'll keep watch for me? Who'll bring me word? He thought. He began greedily questioning the women whether they had seen anything the evening before. They quite understood what he was trying to find out, and completely reassured him. No one had been there. Ivan Fyodorovich had been there that night, everything had been perfectly as usual. Mitya grew thoughtful. He would certainly have to keep watch too, day, but where? Here or at Samsonov's gate? he decided that he must be on the lookout both here and there, and meanwhile. The difficulty was that he had to carry out the new plan that he had made on the journey back. He was sure of its success, but he must not delay acting upon it. Mitya resolved to sacrifice an hour to it. In an hour I shall know everything, I shall settle everything, and then, first of all to Samsonov's. I'll inquire whether Grushenko's there and instantly be back here again, stay till 11, and then to Samsonov's again to bring her home. This was what he decided. He flew home, washed, combed his hair, brushed his clothes, dressed, and went to Madame Holokov's. Alas! He had built his hopes on her. He had resolved to borrow 3,000 from that lady. And what was more, he felt suddenly convinced that she would not refuse to lend it to him. It may be wondered why, if he felt so certain, he had not gone to her at first, one of his own sort, so to speak, instead of to Samsonov, a man he did not know, who was not of his own class, and to whom he hardly knew how to speak. But the fact was that he had never known Madame Holokov well, and had seen nothing of her for the last month, and that he knew she could not endure him. She had detested him from the first because he was engaged to Katerina Ivanovna, while she had, for some reason, suddenly conceived the desire that Katerina Ivanovna should throw him over, and marry the charming, chivalrously refined Ivan, who had such excellent manners. Mitya's manners she detested. Mitya positively laughed at her, and had once said about her that she was just as lively and at her ease as she was uncultivated. But that morning in the cart a brilliant idea had struck him. If she is so anxious I should not marry Katerina Ivanovna, and he knew she was positively hysterical upon the subject, why should she refuse me now the 3,000, just to enable me to leave Katya and get away from her forever? These spoiled fine ladies, if they set their hearts on anything, will spare no expense to satisfy their caprice. Besides, she's so rich, Mitya argued. As for his plan, it was just the same as before. It consisted of the offer of his rights to Chermashenya, but not with a commercial object, as it had been with Samsonov, not trying to allure a lady with the possibility of making a profit of 6 or 7 thousand, but simply as a security for the debt. As he worked out this new idea, Mitya was enchanted with it, but so it always was with him in all his undertakings, in all his sudden decisions. He gave himself up to every new idea with passionate enthusiasm. Yet, when he mounted the steps of Madame Holokov's house he felt a shiver of fear run down his spine. At that moment he saw fully, as a mathematical certainty, that this was his last hope, that if this broke down, nothing else was left him in the world but to rob and murder someone for the 3,000. It was 7:30 when he rang at the bell. At first fortune seemed to smile upon him. As soon as he was announced he was received with extraordinary rapidity. As though she were waiting for me, thought Mitya, and as soon as he had been led to the drawing room, the lady of the house herself ran in, and declared at once that she was expecting him. I was expecting you. I was expecting you. Though I had no reason to suppose you would come to see me, as you will admit yourself. Yet, I did expect you. You may marvel at my instinct, Dmitri Fyodorovich, but I was convinced all the morning that you would come. That is certainly wonderful, madam, observed Mitya, sitting down limply, but I have come to you on a matter of great importance. On a matter of supreme importance for me, that is, madam. For me alone. And I hasten, I know you've come on most important business. Dmitri Fyodorovich, it's not a case of presentiment, no reactionary harking back to the miraculous. Have you heard about Father Zossima? This is a case of mathematics. You couldn't help coming, after all that has passed with Katerina Ivanovna, you couldn't, that's a mathematical certainty. The realism of actual life, madam, that's what it is. But allow me to explain. Realism indeed, Dmitri Fyodorovich. I'm all for realism now. I've seen too much of miracles. You've heard that Father Zossima is dead? No, madam, it's the first time I've heard of it. Mitya was a little surprised. The image of Alishaw rose to his mind. Last night, and only imagine. Madam, said Mitya, I can imagine nothing except that I'm in a desperate position, and that if you don't help me, everything will come to grief, and I first of all. Excuse me for the triviality of the expression, but I'm in a fever. I know that you're in a fever. You could hardly fail to be, and whatever you may say to me, I know beforehand. I have long been thinking over your destiny, Dmitri Fyodorovich. I am watching over it and studying it. Oh, believe me, I'm an experienced doctor of the soul, Dmitri Fyodorovich. Madam, if you are an experienced doctor, I'm certainly an experienced patient, said Mitya, with an effort to be polite, and I feel that if you are watching over my destiny in this way, you will come to my help in my ruin, and so allow me, at least, to explain to you the plan with which I have ventured to come to you. And what I am hoping of you. I have come, madam. Don't explain it. It's of secondary importance. But as for help, you're not the first I have helped, Dmitri Fyodorovich. You have most likely heard of my cousin, Madame Belmsoff. Her husband was ruined, had come to grief, as you characteristically express it, Dmitri Fyodorovich. I recommended him to take to horse breeding, and now he's doing well. Have you any idea of horse breeding, Dmitri Fyodorovich? Not the faintest, madam, madam, not the faintest, cried Mitya, in nervous impatience, positively starting from his seat. I simply implore you, madam, to listen to me. Only give me 2 minutes of free speech that I may just explain to you everything, the whole plan with which I have come. Besides, I am short of time. I'm in a fearful hurry, Mitya cried hysterically, feeling that she was just going to begin talking again, and hoping to cut her short. I have come in despair. In the last gasp of despair, to beg you to lend me the sum of 3,000, alone, but on safe, most safe security, madam, with the most trustworthy guarantees. Only let me explain. You must tell me all that afterwards, afterwards. Madame Holokov with a gesture demanded silence in her turn, and whatever you may tell me, I know it all beforehand, I've told you so already. You ask for a certain sum, for 3,000, but I can give you more, immeasurably more. I will save you, Dmitri Fyodorovich, but you must listen to me. Mitya started from his seat again. Madam, will you really be so good? He cried, with strong feeling. Good God, you've saved me. You have saved a man from a violent death, from a bullet. My eternal gratitude, I will give you more, infinitely more than 3,000, cried Madame Holokov, looking with a radiant smile at Mitya's ecstasy. Infinitely? But I don't need so much. I only need that fatal 3,000, and on my part one can give security for that sum with infinite gratitude, and I propose a plan which... Enough, Dmitri Fyodorovich, it's said and done. Madame Holokov cut him short, with the modest triumph of beneficence. I have promised to save you, and I will save you. I will save you as I did Belmsoff. What do you think of the gold mines, Dmitri Fyodorovich? Of the gold mines, madam. I have never thought anything about them. But I have thought of them for you. Thought of them over and over again. I have been watching you for the last month. I've watched you 100 times as you've walked past, saying to myself, that's a man of energy who ought to be at the gold mines. I've studied your gait and come to the conclusion, that's a man who would find gold. From my gait, madam, said Mitya, smiling. Yes, from your gait. You surely don't deny that character can be told from the gait, Dmitri Fyodorovich. Science supports the idea. I'm all for science and realism now. After all this business with Father Zossima, which has so upset me, from this very day I'm a realist and I want to devote myself to practical usefulness. I'm cured. Enough. As Turgeny says. But madam, the 3,000 you so generously promised to lend me. It is yours, Dmitri Fyodorovich, Madame Holokov cut in at once. The money is as good as in your pocket, not 3, but 3 million, Dmitri Fyodorovich, in less than no time. I'll make you a present of the idea, you shall find gold mines, make millions, return and become a leading man, and wake us up and lead us to better things. Are we to leave it all to the Jews? You will found institutions and enterprises of all sorts. You will help the poor, and they will bless you. This is the age of railways, Dmitri Fyodorovich. You'll become famous and indispensable to the Department of Finance, which is so badly off at present. The depreciation of the ruble keeps me awake at night, Dmitri Fyodorovich. People don't know that side of me. Madam, madam. Dmitri interrupted with an uneasy presentiment. I shall indeed, perhaps, follow your advice, your wise advice, madam. I shall perhaps set off to the gold mines. I'll come and see you again about it. Many times, indeed. But now, that 3,000 you so generously. Oh, that would set me free, and if you could too, day. You see, I haven't a minute to lose today. Enough, Dmitri Fyodorovich, enough. Madame Holokov interrupted emphatically. The question is, will you go to the gold mines or not? Have you quite made up your mind? Answer yes or no. I will go, madam, afterwards. I'll go where you like. But now. Wait! Cried Madame Holokov. And jumping up and running to a handsome bureau with numerous little drawers, she began pulling out one drawer after another, looking for something with desperate haste. The 3,000, thought Mitya, his heart almost stopping, and at the instant. Without any papers or formalities. That's doing things in gentlemanly style. She's a splendid woman, if only she didn't talk so much. Here! Cried Madame Holokov, running back joyfully to Mitya, here is what I was looking for. It was a tiny silver icon on a cord, such as is sometimes worn next the skin with a cross. This is from Kiev, Dmitri Fyodorovich, she went on reverently, from the relics of the holy martyr, Varvara. Let me put it on your neck myself, and with it dedicate you to a new life, to a new career. And she actually put the cord round his neck, and began arranging it. In extreme embarrassment, Mitya bent down and helped her, and at last he got it under his necktie and collar through his shirt to his chest. Now you can set off, Madame Holokov pronounced, sitting down triumphantly in her place again. Madam, I am so touched. I don't know how to thank you, indeed, for such kindness, but, if only you knew how precious time is to me. That sum of money, for which I shall be indebted to your generosity. Oh, madam, since you are so kind, so touchingly generous to me, Mitya exclaimed impulsively, then let me reveal to you. Though, of course, you've known it a long time. That I love somebody here. I have been false to Katya. Katerina Ivanovna, I should say. Oh, I've behaved inhumanly, dishonorably to her, but I fell in love here with another woman. A woman whom you, madam, perhaps, despise, for you know everything already, but whom I cannot leave on any account, and therefore that 3,000 now. Leave everything, Dmitri Fyodorovich. Madame Holokov interrupted in the most decisive tone. Leave everything, especially women. Gold mines are your goal, and there's no place for women there. Afterwards, when you come back rich and famous, you will find the girl of your heart in the highest society. That will be a modern girl, a girl of education and advanced ideas. By that time the dawning woman question will have gained ground, and the new woman will have appeared. Madam, that's not the point, not at all. Mitya clasped his hands in entreaty. Yes it is, Dmitri Fyodorovich, just what you need, the very thing you're yearning for, though you don't realize it yourself. I am not at all opposed to the present woman movement, Dmitri Fyodorovich. The development of woman, and even the political emancipation of woman in the near future, that's my ideal. I've a daughter myself, Dmitri Fyodorovich, people don't know that side of me. I wrote a letter to the author, Shchedrin, on that subject. He has taught me so much about the vocation of woman.